congestion on the roads every single day.
The failure to upgrade infrastructure.
If you keep increasing and growing in a finite world, the whole thing ends up in doom.
How big is too big? This year, Australia's population ticked over 25 million. We cracked the milestone almost three decades quicker than experts forecast in the late 90s. And governments are now playing catch-up with infrastructure.
Says simply, the roads, rail, schools and hospitals can't keep up with the amount of people coming.
What do we do about our capital cities that are bursting at the seams, while some regional areas are desperate for new residents to keep them alive?
There are other parts of the country that are actually crying out for more people.
Is it as simple as forcing people to the country? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Tori Maguire. The signals from the Morrison government that a major policy reset is approaching on population and immigration are getting louder. This week, Population Minister Alan Tudge floated the idea of a new visa condition for some migrants, requiring them to live in regional areas for at least 5 years. Details of how this would work are scant. Meanwhile, New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian has called for a 50% cut in the state's migrant intake.
Let's take a breather, let's take stock, and let's think about how we can sustain our population growth into the future.
Joining me to discuss this in Sydney is politics editor Peter Harcher and from the Canberra Bureau, Chief Political Correspondent David Crow. Thank you for being here.
G'day, Tori.
Hi, Tori.
Later this episode, we're heading to a country town that's seen a big increase in foreign migrants to see how it's worked out. And Senior Herald reporter Matt Wade will explain why a highly mobile workforce has actually saved us from some of the worst of economic shocks. But first, Peter, let's start with the politics of all this. Is population going to be where Scott Morrison plants his first big policy flag?
It's certainly looking like it, and this is an issue that the Conservatives have long judged favours them. The terms of this debate favour them. You'll remember, I mean, it's not without risk for a leader. You'll remember when Kevin Rudd said, "I'm all in favour of a big Australia," and there was a terrible outcry, and he backed down. And then when Julia Gillard replaced him, she appointed a minister for population. Now everybody's forgotten this, but Tony Burke was Australia's minister for population, and his job was to say nothing about it, which he did very effectively.
Shut it down completely, isn't it?
Just to shut it down, because the Labor Party considers that the ethnic communities and the whole immigration ecosystem is a pro-Labor constituency, and therefore they have to show maximum support. The Conservatives take a different view, that they can afford to be more stringent on the subject. Tony Abbott has led the Conservative debate on this. He's for months now, for maybe a year or more, has argued for a halving of Australia's overall immigration intake. The debate has become largely turned into a debate about congestion, and they're the terms on which Scott Morrison and his new Minister for Population, or congestion busting, as he calls Alan Tudge, have taken it up.
David, what's Scott Morrison's form on this issue? It's something. I mean, he was the first one to come out after Tony Abbott called for that cut and say that our economy can't hack it.
Yes, as Treasurer, he stood for economic growth and economic growth through migration. He's got a long-standing interest in population policy and in migration. Around the time that Tony Burke, as Peter mentioned, was Labor's population minister, before he was stopping the boat, Scott Morrison, in opposition, was responsible for population and productivity. So his interest in this area goes back quite a long way. And he's been a voice of moderation in the internal coalition argument about what to do about the numbers. And we saw that during the leadership spill in August, where Peter Dutton was out there arguing as an alternative leader to have a stronger cut to migration. And Scott Morrison is just not positioned there, and he's reshaped the ministry by appointing David Coleman as immigration minister. And David Coleman represents the southern Sydney seat around Hurstville, a very ethnically diverse area where he really gets a multicultural Australia. That's been a very interesting signal from Scott Morrison about where he stands. He's not anti-immigration, but he knows he's got to deal with the congestion problem.
So, Peter, politically, how does someone get this right? I mean, there is an economic argument. There is accusations of dog whistling if we talk about
you know, bringing down the rate. People accuse the people who want to do that of racism. But then there's legitimate arguments about sustainability in this country, whether we have the space for, you know, a big Australia or not. How risky is this as territory for the government to play in?
Well, the risk is being seen to be xenophobic or racist, as you say, dog whistling. Australia has the highest proportion of either immigrants or so first or second generation immigrants in the world, at far higher than the US as a proportion, which surprises people. But
yeah,
it surprises me. Yeah, but it's a fact. So it's almost 50% of the country is either an immigrant or their parents were born elsewhere. That's a big potential upset to cause if you look like you're being nakedly anti-immigration or nakedly xenophobic. So you know it's not in the national interest to set off a divisive debate, and it's not in the political interest of either party either to offend that huge chunk of the country. Smartest way to do it politically is to head in the direction which they're already doing, and that is to say, this isn't about immigration, yes or no. It's not a question of principle. This is about how to manage immigration, how to manage people, where the population is, how it moves, and how it best serves the interests of the country. So rather than the principle issue of immigration, it's the management question. And this is where this particular proposal about encouraging forcing is the way that the government's presenting it, forcing newly arrived immigrants to spend some years, perhaps up to as many as 5 years, in a regional area. That's where that comes in.
Right. David, have they given any detail on how this would work?
No, and I think they're at a point now where the government has been talking so much about the idea of encouraging migrants to go to the regions that it's now under pressure to explain exactly how it would do that. It says that it wants to apply some visa conditions that would require some migrants to be staying in the regions for longer. But what exactly would those conditions be, and what visas would they apply to? Because there are so many parts of the migration program where you cannot actually tell people where to live. Obviously, as a fundamental factor, if you're a permanent migrant, once you're permanent, you can move where you like. That is the way the rules work. For instance, if somebody brings in a spouse, they can't be told where to live. Family reunion is in the same category. So you've got to look at things like skilled worker visas, where they're sponsored by an employer. We already have some regional visa programs where people go out to the regions, and that's a condition of their visa, basically. But that's a relatively small part of the visa program now. And I think the reality of this, beneath all the political rhetoric, is that there are only so many levers the government can pull in order to get more migrants out to the regions. And one of the big factors is everybody acknowledges that a lot of the job creation and a lot of the demand for skills is actually in the big cities, not in some of those country areas. And if the demand for jobs is in the cities, then that's where the employer-sponsored visas will probably be applied for.
So, Peter, New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian, she is a first-generation Australian. Her parents are migrants, and yet she has come out this week and called for a huge cut to migration to New South Wales. This will put her very much at odds with Prime Minister Scott Morrison, probably for the first time. We've got a New South Wales election approaching next year. We've got a federal election approaching either just before or just after. How is this going to play for these two quite disparate camps, but both from the coalition?
Well, it reflects, first of all, the functional division between the Commonwealth and state levels, where the Commonwealth decides the number of immigrants, but the states have to build the infrastructure. Mostly, it falls upon the states to accommodate them. And what we see Gladys Berejiklian doing is reading from the old Bob Carr playbook. Bob Carr famously said Sydney is full, but knowing in the full knowledge that he had no control over the number of people coming into New South Wales or where they went, it was really just political positioning, and more specifically to give him an excuse for not building the infrastructure that Sydney and New South Wales needed. And I think what you see Gladys Berejiklian doing now is the same thing.
She's certainly building a lot more infrastructure, though, at the moment.
Yeah, she is. It never catches up. It's never quite enough. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it, that we have a country that's been growing rapidly for two centuries, and yet we pretend that we need to build infrastructure only for the existing population. It's entirely obvious. Each time a new project is finished, it's most of them almost immediately are full or inadequate. The visionaries who built, for example, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, it took until 1980 to reach capacity. It took more than half a century. Now we're building projects that are at capacity on day one when they cut the ribbon.
Before they've even gotten off the ground.
Exactly.
Sorry, I was going to barge in there, Peter and Tori, just to point out, Gladys Berejiklian has a point. She has limited control, well, no control over the numbers, but the numbers have grown substantially, and it's now 105,000 net overseas migration into New South Wales, and it is roughly double what it was under the Howard government. So that fundamental point, she's right on the numbers. But when you drill down to what that 105,000 net overseas migration actually means, it means things like 40,000 foreign students. It means 20,000 skilled workers who are brought in because employers say that they need them. And what's not clear is how you would run New South Wales if you were to say to the universities in Sydney, sorry, but you can't have 40,000 foreign students. We've got to cut that number. And so you start having this big fight about what that number should be when really the ultimate control is in Canberra, not in Macquarie Street anyway.
Is it in both their best interest to sort this out between themselves rather than on the front page of the newspapers?
Well, it's probably both in their best interest to have an argument about it, to appeal to their separate constituencies. But the practical management questions are the sorts of things that Morrison is now lining up to deal with. So, you know, Bob Carr, for example, made his famous call, Sydney is full. Since then, Sydney's population has grown by more than 1 million people. Well, thanks, Bob. So saying this stuff from a state premier doesn't actually help.
And David, where is Labor on all this? Because it is highly possible that within the next 6 months or so, we'll have a New South Wales Labor government and a federal Labor government. What's their plan?
Labor has no objection to the idea of encouraging migrants to go to the region. Their plan at the moment is to ask the government to do something that the government's not going to do. Bill Shorten has written to Scott Morrison to say, please set up an independent panel as part of the Federal Treasury to decide what the population settings should be. That's not going to happen because we know that Scott Morrison and his ministers are already working on something that's going through the cabinet process to be a whole of government policy on population and migration. So they're going to stick to that. Labor's going to have to take a wait and see approach and see whether it will accept some of the changes to visa conditions and so forth. Possibly we'll see a debate on that in the parliament before the next election, where there'll be decisions made about whether to amend some of the visa rules. Now, and this happened last year because the government tightened the rules on the 457 skilled worker program. There could be other tightening ahead, but I think that it will become an election issue. And I think one thing that we're seeing at the moment, which surely is disheartening for me as a correspondent and probably for voters as well, we're seeing this endless discussion about let's have a national conversation about immigration and population. I think we're past time where we see a few practical measures that the parliament can vote on and then voters can see at the election.
So there's another big story out of Canberra this week that I'd like to get into with both of you. The federal government has been sitting on the recommendations of a review into religious freedom for commissioned in the wake of the same-sex marriage vote. On Wednesday, The Herald and The Age published parts of the report, including recommendations to enshrine the rights of religious schools to discriminate against students based on their sexual orientation or relationship status. For starters, David, why hasn't this report been released?
It's so sensitive. It's an area that threatens to revive a lot of the internal government and Liberal Party agonising over same-sex marriage and religious freedom. The review was only set up because those who lost the debate on same-sex marriage a year ago were worried that marriage equality meant a threat to freedom of expression, freedom of religion, and so they set up this review led by Philip Ruddock. It handed down the report in May. it's been too touchy for the government to handle. I think when Malcolm Turnbull had his leadership under pressure, the last thing he needed was another divisive debate within the Liberal Party over a big social reform. So that's why it hasn't seen the light of day. It's really only a matter of time before it's fully public, and the government has to actually confront these recommendations from Philip Ruddock and take a position.
Peter, it's only just over a week out from the Wentworth by-election. The government would have really preferred to not be talking about this during the lead-up to that crucial vote, wouldn't they?
Yeah, you bet. And it's already brought out divisions. It only took hours. And the sort of divisions David's just talked about are already obvious within the Liberal Party. You had a Conservative in the form of Alex Hawke saying that, you know, we absolutely need to legislate to give this power to schools to refuse enrolments based on gender. You had Tim Wilson, a moderate Liberal, former Australian Human Rights Commissioner, saying the exact opposite and taking very vocal positions. So this is exactly the sort of thing, you're right, they don't want to talk about this. You know, Wentworth is a strong, is one of the central Jewish population zones of Sydney. The last thing they want to do is to be seen to be doing anything that looks discriminatory in any way, shape or form. But, you know, the Liberals are reaping what they sowed. Malcolm Turnbull, at the time of the same-sex marriage debate, wanted to sideline this because this was an issue thrown up by John Howard and Tony Abbott as a way of derailing the same-sex marriage plebiscite. So they put this aside as an inquiry, which was just giving themselves a time bomb. That time bomb is now detonating.
Peter and David, thanks so much for joining me
today.
Pleasure,
Tori.
Thank you, Tori.
As the government makes promises about population and the movement of new migrants, the practical mechanics of the program remain scant. For residents of regional towns, what exactly would it look like? Our producer David Escort takes us to the community of Nil in Western Victoria to hear about the experience of the Karen Refugee Group that have breathed new life into the small regional town.
What happened in the tiny town of Nil, halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide, is a story that's becoming increasingly familiar in regional Australia. There's work for people that want it, but nobody around to do it. The managing director of the local abattoir, Loverduck, wanted to expand. After spending thousands advertising locally with no luck, he heard about a group of migrants from Myanmar that were living in Werribee on the outskirts of Melbourne.
It's called the Karen State in what is now Myanmar. So yeah, they were a displaced people group that were forced out of their homes and ended up in the refugee camps on the Thai border.
That's Alison Creek from the Nil Learning Centre. She works with the Karen refugees who have settled in town.
She heard about the Karen living in Werribee and that they might be suited to that work. So he went to Werribee and, you know, talked to the community there, and then brought some of them up to have a look, and they were keen.
In January 2010, a busload of Karen visited Nil for the first time. A fortnight later, the first families moved in. Five of them began working at the Loverduck Abattoir. The families had fled persecution in Karen State, Myanmar, and had arrived in Australia with very little English.
Yeah, so John was obviously very keen to support them as they settled here in Nil, obviously providing work, but very much he and his wife had a heart to help them settle in. And as part of that, they approached Nil Learning Centre and said, can you offer English classes to help with that transition?
The centre even ran what they called Aussie lifestyle classes, which required local volunteers from Nil to take Karen residents around town.
A class called Aussie Lifestyle Class was started up in the daytime for women who were interested. It was open to both men and women, but it was the women that it attracted. So we then ran classes for a few hours a week where the women could come along.
The education went even further. Classes on how to cook, do crafts, and gain skills they could use in the workforce. It was crucial, says Creek, in the Karen becoming a part of the community.
Learn about living here in Australia through excursions around the local community, to the hospital, to the supermarket. We had people come in and speak on topics, health topics. We had cooking classes, a whole range of things that we felt would be beneficial.
People in the town who were initially sceptical of the Karen came around as friends and relatives reached out to the community and they were woven into the social fabric of Nil.
Do whatever was going to help them settle here in Nil. So it might be take them down to the shop, take them to the doctor, help them make appointments. Through that one-on-one interaction, the local people got to know individual Karen people and families and became involved in each other's lives, which I think was a really important part of the Karen people becoming part of the Nil community. It's easy when you don't have close interaction with others, particularly whether it be people from another place or another culture, that you can get wrong ideas in your head about where they're coming from and how they live and what's important to them. So I think by actually having those connections, their misconceptions are broken down and I think friendships form.
Now, the small shop Porpo, adorned with traditional Karen hand-woven patterns, bustles like a community centre, a hub for women in the town to make friends and engage with their adopted community.
Overall, I feel like it's sort of brought out the best in people. And look, I attribute some of that to the nature of the Karen people, because they have been a people group with a strong work ethic who are keen to get involved in things and offer what they can to the community. That has really helped us as well. So when they arrived in Nil, it was probably more a case of just adjusting to a different environment. Some of them who love the city may have had to adjust to being in the country, but generally for them, I've heard them say, this is my village now, and they like they like living in the countryside because that's what their home was like.
Hi, John Sylvester here. I'm the senior crime reporter for The Age. I've been a crime reporter in Melbourne for 40 years, covering gangland wars, outlaw bikies, police corruption, and the underworld of this city. And I've seen a lot of changes in the news business. But take it from me, I believe this newspaper is now filled with the best young news gatherers in decades. Our investigative unit is without doubt the best in The Age's history. This mob produces massive revelations nearly every week, and they're doing stories no one else will touch. And in the era of so-called fake news, we need mainstream media more than ever before. Subscribe to The Age. Support news you can trust.
Matt Wade is a senior reporter from the Sydney Morning Herald who has spent years writing about the economy, infrastructure and population. Matt, you're suspicious of politicians who try to meddle in economic forces.
Well, that's right. You know, one of the things that's been a fundamental part of the Australian economy is freedom of movement. And that has been a really good thing for us. I mean, the fact that workers have been able to move to different parts of the country to respond to opportunities has been a strength for Australia. So when you hear people or politicians talking about imposing some sort of restrictions or rules that mean migrants have to go to certain parts of the country, you start to think from an economic point of view, how's that going to work?
So what do the country areas need as far as the skills that they need to attract to them to keep them vibrant?
Well, I think that's a hard question. I mean, and I think one of the challenges for every regional area in Australia, if they're going to promote employment growth, is to sort of identify their own sort of niche, if you like, their own competitive advantage. Some bigger regional centres can be connected, if you like, to the big cities of Melbourne and Sydney and so forth. But smaller country areas have probably got to really zero in on what they can offer that other regions can't.
And is there a way the government can help them with that? I mean, they need infrastructure, don't they, to be able to sustain bigger populations and attract people to live there?
I think so. But you'd have to say there's a limit, because in the end, there are lots of growth in jobs that tend to aggregate, is the word that, you know, sort of the technical people use, in big cities. So I think, I think infrastructure obviously is important, but I think what's fundamental is for those smaller regional towns and regions to really focus on what it is that their region is going to zero in on and really invest in that kind of stuff and develop employment opportunities around that.
So what's driven the huge internal migration from the country to the city in Australia?
Yeah, well, look, I think you've got some big forces at work that are not just in Australia, they're global. And that is that you've had strong jobs growth in knowledge-based industries, whether it's IT, marketing, media, and the list goes on. Now, those jobs have tended to be located in big cities, and Melbourne and Sydney are very good examples. Both of those cities are now driven by the knowledge economy. They're the growth industries. That's where the jobs are. And so, as a result, if you're a person sitting in whatever part of Australia it might be, whether it's a regional area or a city suburb, and you want to, you've got skills and training or interest in that area, might be as a journalist, those jobs do tend to be aggregating, if you like, conglomerating in big cities.
So the jobs that we need to send to the country are more of the service, public service jobs, doctors, carers.
Well, it's true to say that in most regional areas, the biggest employers nowadays are health and education, retail, these service industries. And that'll always be the case, and that's great. But I think there's a limit to how many of those jobs that any community can have. And so, therefore, this is why I say, especially in regional areas, to zero in on other industries where you're able to really contribute means that there might be more jobs growth in that area. But I think, if you're looking at the policies that the federal government now seems to be talking about, which is to oblige migrants, a certain number of migrants, we don't really know the details, to spend 5 years in a regional area, that's a difficult one, because unless that regional area matches the skills and interests of the migrants, it's going to be a problem.
Mm. So Sydney and Melbourne and South East Queensland, they're experiencing the biggest growth. Who is suffering the most, do you think, between those three areas? Which of the cities is really struggling more?
Well, it's interesting to see that Melbourne, in fact, has had the strongest population growth of any of those cities for a fair period. And in fact, we now know that it's likely Melbourne's going to overtake Sydney as the biggest city in Australia in the next couple of decades. We're not quite sure exactly when, but it'll depend on the continuing rate of population growth. So, there's no doubt, but it's true to say as well that Sydney's also experienced strong growth, and both those cities are experiencing, if you like, the growing pains of the transition to becoming global cities, because they are. Both Melbourne and Sydney are now incredibly integrated into the global economy, and that will mean they change. Their character is likely to change. Now, there's obviously a lot of feelings about that. Some people don't like it. Others think it's a good thing. I think there is some sense of that those cities are inevitably going to change as the global economy changes. The point is both those cities have incredible opportunities. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that both Sydney and Melbourne have had a disproportionate share of migration arriving in those places, they've both got incredibly low unemployment rates.
Right.
They're jobs machines, and that's why migrants are going there. And this is where I think it's going to be tricky for the government to come up with, sustainable policies that mess around with that dynamic.
And so apart from the knowledge economy jobs, which are the more comfortable jobs, what other sort of jobs are available in Sydney and Melbourne that aren't available elsewhere that would suit migrants who want to come and live here?
Well, the point is these growth hubs, if you like, these job hubs, where, high-wage, high-value jobs, high-productivity jobs are being attracted. And you've got to remember that. They're very high-productivity jobs, and that is good for the whole economy because those people pay tax and that creates more jobs inevitably. So, the offices of those jobs have got to be cleaned and they've got to be serviced. There's a lot of, flow on from that,
right,
from those industries. And that often they're the sort of jobs that migrants are getting. But we've got to remember that most of the migrants who settle permanently in Australia are skilled. And again, that means they're more likely to have the sort of interests and skills that suit these new knowledge jobs in the big cities than in regional areas. And we can't just pretend that they're going to go off to some regional area if there's no jobs there that match their skills.
So would there be a risk if there was a certain number of visas that had a requirement to go and live in the country, that would just have the effect of shrinking migration?
It's a good question. I mean, Australia might become a less attractive destination for migration. That's certainly a possibility. I think more likely is a less a more messy outcome where people find themselves in a place where they kind of might have thought that there was some jobs there and they're not really what they expected. The other thing is our economy changes a lot. I mean, if you think of the last 10 years, we've had the global financial crisis and then we had the mining boom. And one of the things that helped Australia was the ability for people to move to other places for work. So the mining boom's a great example, you know. It attracted a lot of workers to mining sort of activities. And then, thankfully, our labour market was flexible enough for them in a relatively undisruptive way to come to different places to work. And so a lot of people actually ended up, you know, in the suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne who might have been working right. in mining sites. So that is how our economy works. And if you start sort of placing restrictions on workers and when they can where they can move, and this is exactly what the government's proposal seems to be, where migrants are going to be obliged to live in one area for 5 years or whatever, you start to mess with that those economic forces. You know, we're starting to pretend that those economic laws should somehow not apply.
So if we're not going to force migrants to move to the country, how could we entice them to do it?
Obviously, as I said before, it's up to regions to think carefully about industries that they want to promote and really develop that are attractive to people. I think, though, that the fact is that it's difficult. I mean, I think even here in we're talking in Sydney, there's a push in New South Wales to try and get businesses to locate more in Western Sydney, because that's where a lot of people live, and it'd be much better for them if they didn't have to commute long distance to sort of the CBD. They could go to a big centre like Parramatta or Liverpool or Penrith or whatever. But even that's proving difficult. It's not an easy process. And if it's difficult for the New South Wales government to convince businesses to locate in Parramatta,
which imagine, is a 20-minute train ride from Central.
Yeah, which is very close. How much harder will it be to get them to locate in other parts of the state or a region somewhere else in the country? Because you see, often businesses are interested in having being near a labour market where they can find the workers they need. And you can't just create that out of nothing.
Matt, thanks so much for your time. Thanks to our guests for this episode, David Crowe, Peter Hartcher and Matt Wade. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by Rachel Dexter and David Escort, with technical assistance from David McMillan, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.